now being present. With that gavel, I have just called to order the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February the 9th, 2016. We are gathered today for the purpose of a work session on a federal grant request, a work session on a report from Housing and Community Services, and an informational meeting on key performance measure update from Housing and Community Services. Ms. Deister, if you want to give us an introduction, we will get underway.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, if you would be so kind as to open the work session for the Veterans Affairs item.
Madam Chair, or Madam LFO, I have just opened the work session on a federal grant request from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you so much. What you have before you is the Department of Veterans Affairs is here to ask permission to apply for a federal grant for up to $100,000 to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for transportation of Oregon veterans in highly rural areas. If this sounds familiar, it's because it ought to be. You remember back in January, you approved several of the counties. There were two that were eligible that did not apply. ODVA has since become informed of us. Subsequent grant opportunity for those folks that had not previously received funding. It's my understanding that both of those counties, Harney and Lake County, will be applying for those dollars. And the application deadline is February 12th. Once again, there is no additional matching funds required and no staff is anticipated to be needed to administer the grant. Hopefully I haven't stole all of Mr. Smith's thunder.
I think you might have just given a speech. Director Smith and anybody else from Team Veteran, Ms. Brickman, welcome. Now, would these be Frontier County? I'm just trying to get the definitions.
Okay. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I think the federal VA had a bug in our hearing room last time because literally that same week that we were last in front of you for the other eight counties, Representative Whitsitt had a question on how come other highly rural counties such as Lake and Harney had not been eligible. And while they had not been eligible since they had not applied for that first time of the grant cycle back to 13 or 14, now they have broadened that pool. So now we are able to go back to the well to apply for both Harney and Lake. And we were able to send out a ODVA team member to make sure that they were able to get linked in. So we should be, with your permission.
Director Smith, may I interrupt you long enough? You neglected to introduce yourself for the record. If you would fix that, that'd be great.
I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you.
So with your permission, we will be reapplying for up to $100,000, $50,000 per county for both Harney and Lake to better support the transportation of their veterans to both federal VA appointments and community care appointments.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Director Smith? Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the effort that you've put forward to contact those counties and to apply for this. It means a great deal. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions or comments? Then the chair would happily entertain a motion to we better hear the recommendations. What a good idea. Ms. Deister.
The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request to apply.
Ms. Brickman.
Chair Johnson, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, Tamara Brickman from the Chief Financial Office, we recommend you approve the request.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair, I thought those were fine recommendations. I'd like to move them.
Thank you, colleagues. You have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion to approve the LFO recommendation. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? Approved. Thank you very much, Director Smith. We need a carrier, and I think I have a volunteer. Thank you very much. All right, we're going to close the work session on Veterans Affairs, and we are going to open a work session on Housing and Community Services Department for a report. Invite up Ms. Van Vliet, Ms. Joy, Mr. Diaz, and Mr. Fieldman, or any subset thereof.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll go quickly and then sit down.
That would be fine. Good afternoon. As you all are getting settled, I would just like to remind you that prior to speaking, introduce yourself for the record.
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Today we are here with the Oregon Commission on Voluntary Action and Service, or Oregon Volunteers, to provide a report. In the 2015 legislative session, as part of our budget, you requested that Oregon Volunteers with OHCS report on the status of the commission, its future, and its financial stability. By way of history, you may remember that in 2001, Oregon Volunteers was put inside Oregon Housing and Community Services. We primarily provide financial and administrative support to the organization. Oregon Volunteers is an independent commission, and their work is directed and governed by an independent board, which is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
Edited.
Since 2001, OHCS has provided administrative, procurement, and financial assistance. In addition, my agency has provided administrative funds in varying degrees. When the agency had significant bond revenues, this was easy to do. But in recent years, as bond revenues have declined, it has become more difficult for the agency to provide these resources, particularly in this climate where every dollar should probably be going to ease the housing crisis we are facing here in Oregon. In 2015, this subcommittee in the legislature gave OHCS $250,000 to help subsidize the cost of administering Oregon Volunteers, and we very much appreciate those resources. I do want to give you a brief update on these funds. We are using them to help pay for the operations of Oregon Volunteers. Unfortunately, the $250,000 is not sufficient to cover the entire cost of operating the organization this biennium. The deficit grew larger when we recently received the final results of a 2012 audit. The audit, which you will hear more about from the commission, required that Oregon Volunteers repay a small amount of federal grant resources that were found to be used for ineligible expenses. Oregon Volunteers has worked hard to ensure strong systems are in place moving forward. Unfortunately, as you'll see in the report, the organization has had significant cutbacks in monitoring staff due to a lack of resources. The report you will see will outline the deficit of resources and the investment that will be required by the state in order to sustain the organization into the future. At this time, I will turn it over to the board chair, Bill Diaz, Kathleen Joy, the executive director, and I believe other members of the commission.
Thank you very much. Before Ms. Van Bleet leaves, any questions for her? Thank you very much, Madam Director, and we'll invite up others. And I just want to say this before you begin your testimony. I remember with great fondness how respectful my father was of your very distinguished parents, and he and Judge Diaz were good friends. And when
Thank
I
you.
See you, I think of both of them. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee, just for the record, I'm Bill Diaz, Chair of Oregon Volunteers, and thank you, Margaret, for the introduction. On behalf of the members of the Oregon Volunteers Commission, thank you for giving us this opportunity to tell the story of a small state entity that has delivered important outcomes with little fanfare or recognition for the past 22 years. And we are grateful for this opportunity. And I'd like for members of our commission who came here in support of us to be recognized. They're sitting back there, so I'd like to a show of hands. And you'll see a lot of commissioners are here, and we really do engage in the work we do with this commission. Like all of our work, the report reflects the values of our organization. Community, strengthening Oregon through service and volunteerism, is the heart of everything we do. Effectiveness, the results of an efficient, effective, strategic use of resources, will further the commission's mission. We will make decisions in line with short and long-term priorities. Mutual benefit, we take intentional action to create a triple win, a win for the commission, for our partners, and for Oregon communities. Integrity, we do what we say we'll do and only what we are able to do. Partnership, we invest time in building relationships, honoring diverse perspectives, and creating win-3 solutions. Innovation and creativity, we encourage new ideas and find solutions to better serve all of Oregon's communities. We hope that you have had time to review the report and appendices provided earlier to you. This presentation will be brief. It will cover the highlights, but important additional information is included in the report itself, so we urge you to review the complete document. A more complete history of volunteerism in government and the commission can be found in a timeline on page 4 of our report. The two key historical activities not shown on this slide are the 1980 ATIA Task Force on Volunteerism report and the 1990 Federal National and Community Service Act that brought federal funding for service to Oregon through the Office of the Secretary of State. You'll hear more about those later. In the meantime, this slide highlights the history of the Oregon Volunteers Commission. Now, it was created in 1994 to establish the state's eligibility for federal AmeriCorps and Learn and Serve funding. Created during the Roberts-Kitzhaber transition, no executive order was ever created, and the commission existed only under the federal statute until 2001. At that time, we received our first official name and were transferred from the informal location in what was then the Department of Community Colleges to a statutory relationship with the Housing and Community Services Department. That was in 2001. The timeline shows other highlights that occurred between 2001 and 2013. Today, we focus on the aftermath of the OHCS transformation that began in 2012. In order for you to provide direction on if and where we should relocate, we would like you to know a little bit more about who we are. This slide shows our mission and vision statements as well as our four program areas. In addition to this information, page 5 of the report provides details on our value and on the 5 strategic goals from our current state service plan. The next 4 slides will provide a quick overview of each of our 4 program areas. You can read more about them on pages 6 through 10 in the report. AmeriCorps is the Commission's oldest and largest program. We would be happy to provide more information to you about any of the programs in Oregon that host more than 300 stipended volunteer members each year in communities throughout the state through grants administration by our Commission. Court-appointed special advocates, CASA, came into the Oregon Volunteers Program portfolio in 2012 at the request of a legislative task force. The current biennium appropriation is $2.498 million, which is granted to 23 organizations serving Oregon counties. A statewide research project in 2002 led to the development of the Commission's volunteer program. The research built on a report released by Governor Vic Atilla back in 1980. Activities included reinstating the former Governor's Volunteer Awards program, creating a state committee on volunteerism to provide policy recommendations to the Commission, developing promotional and outreach materials for recruitment, and convening a variety of practitioner groups. One of the primary outcomes was the development and implementation of a statewide volunteer engagement capacity training program, which had more than 50 authorized trainers by 2011. The civic engagement program was created in 2006. Although never a large program, the State Committee on Civic Engagement for years has been the only regular convening of organizations involved in the many aspects of civic engagement. This program oversees community conversations and dialogue sessions, releases information on volunteerism and civic health, and until 2012 sponsored regular cross-discipline conferences. And now, on to the meat of our report. The first requirement of the budget note was to provide an analysis of the current financial status of the Commission and a plan to ensure financial stability without subsidy from OHCS in 2017 to 19 and into the future. Our commissioners have been concerned about financial stability since the federal match requirements for Commission operating grants reached its maximum of $1 for $1 in 1999. Federal funding as the single source of operating funds is not ideal and can be dangerous, as we in the Commission learned in late 2011 when Congress made significant cuts in funding for state commissions all over the country. Here in Oregon, the reduction equaled 68% of previous funding. This led to a 67% staff reduction, even though AmeriCorps programming has increased significantly since that time, and we've also added CASA to our program portfolio, so we're doing more with much less. This slide provides an overview of anticipated 2015 to 17 revenue and expenditures. As you can see, the revenue shortfall is $232,210 for our volunteer operations and $260,048 for the CASA program, for a total of $492,258. the one-time appropriation of $250,000 that you approved for 2015 to 17 eliminates the projected volunteer operations deficit. However, as Ms. Van Vliet discussed in her opening comments, the management decision of a 2011 audit has resulted in additional costs of $42,500. We still think this is in error. We will continue our efforts to correct the error so we don't have to pay these funds.
May I interrupt you for just
Certainly.
A second? You said the audit resulted in a finding of $40,000. I've heard that the audit is closer to $150,000. Which is the correct number? The audit found misappropriation.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathleen Joy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Volunteers. The final audit figure is $130,400-something. All but $42,500 that is funds owed back from the three programs that were involved in the audit. They are all in the process. They're being invoiced to repay the funds to the state.
Okay.
They're in total agreement with the final decision.
I just want to reconcile those numbers. And colleagues, given this very distressing news, I'm going to ask that there be a complete explanation for the committee about how it is that we ended up making appropriations to grantees that have resulted in a negative audit. I mean, I got to be honest with you. I was prepared to come down here and ask for resignations, given that the agency had made what appeared at first blush to be inappropriate grants. Having spoken with your past chairman, I think it would be useful to have it explained on the record exactly how we got to this place. But, Mr. Diaz, please finish your testimony. I was just trying to reconcile the numbers.
That's fine, and we'll be happy. Mike was here. I wasn't on the commission when this happened, but Mike was here when this occurred, and he'll be happy to talk to the audit.
I think that would be helpful. But please finish your testimony.
Thank you very much. Pages 13 to 16 of the report provide details on our research and the options that we have considered when attempting to meet the requirements of the budget note to provide a plan to ensure financial stability without subsidy. Frankly, we were unable to provide such a plan. The staff reductions made in 2012 exhausted our ability to reduce staff and still meet our federal and state legislative mandates. We have worked with graduate students to identify options for increased stable funding or alternative organizational structures and come up empty on both counts. We also went through an exercise in which we prioritized the 23 activities spelled out in our state statutes, only to realize that we couldn't even meet the top three priorities with further staff reductions. After exhaustive studies and research, we have reached the conclusion that there's no way to achieve financial sustainability without an ongoing investment of state funding to support our efforts. Without a regular investment, the commission cannot be viable. Federal and state mandates cannot continue to be met. Without a service commission, Oregon will no longer be eligible to receive federal AmeriCorps funding. A new search will have to begin for another administrative home for state CASA funds, and our state will be the poorer for the loss of an entity to focus engagement efforts in the public and private sectors. The second requirement of the budget note was to provide a comparison of Oregon's service commission and those of other states. Pages 17 to 20 of the report provide detailed information on the 9 other commissions that were selected for this report. As you can see, we learned that 89% of the commissions we compared receive state general fund support, that 67% have larger overall staffs than we do, including two states with long-term hiring freezes, and that 78% have a lower AmeriCorps program-to-staff ratio. The report also provides information on programs carried out by other commissions that could influence future direction for Oregon Volunteers. The final requirement of the budget note was to recommend one of 6 options as a future administrative structure for Oregon Volunteers. More details on our research can be found on pages 22 to 23. Option 1, remain an entity within the Housing and Community Services Department. And you already know that this is probably not going to be a recommendation. While we always are appreciative to OHCS for the past 15 years of support, we agree with the findings of their transformation report, which basically says that we're not a fit for their mission. In addition to the financial resources expended on our support that could instead be directed toward the state's critical housing needs, we also fail this mission compatibility test. It is time for us to find a new and permanent administrative structure for volunteerism and engagement in Oregon for it to really rise to the level that it should be. We could become incorporated into another state agency. The HB 4082 work group, which made the final recommendation to the 2014 legislature regarding location of support for CASA, filled two purposes when making its final review of all state agencies to ensure that there was no better or legal fit for administering funds for CASA. Members also looked at every state agency through the additional lens of suitability for a new home for Oregon volunteers. None could be identified that met either the mission fit or the program compatibility elements that were being sought. Option three, be incorporated into an existing not-for-profit agency. The commissioners have been looking at this as a potential option since we issued a report to the 2005 legislature on the potential of nonprofit status for our activities. Discussions with a variety of community partners and potential homes began in earnest in 2012 following receipt of the Graduate Student Sustainability Report. In the end, we learned that our lack of adequate administrative funding, our highly regulated programming with its many, many compliance requirements, the possibility of interorganizational conflict when considering applications to local foundations, and the inability to find a mission fit left us with no viable candidates for this option. Option four, be incorporated into an institution of higher education. In many ways, becoming fully integrated into Portland State University might be the easiest solution. After all, we have been part of the university since our inception, clear back in 1994, and we have a long history on campus. The hesitancy to pursue this option related to the concern about costs. As everyone knows, investments in higher education have not kept pace with costs, resulting in unfunded administrative costs and eventually higher tuition. While the university policy allows a partial subsidy of their finance and administration charges for federal funds, but does not do the same for state funds. Unless an agreement could be brokered with the university, this seemed to be an unrealistic option. Excuse me for a moment. I've got to get a little drink of water.
Mr. Diaz, is this all is laid out in your report. In the interest of moving us along, I think we've all got the report in front of us, and we can just scan it.
So we could become an independent not-for-profit entity, or we could become an independent state agency, and rather than go through each to move it along.
Yeah, I think what I'd like to do is to have an explanation of why it is that you've now got this $137,000 problem. And then,
Could I, Senator? I'd like to get to the part of our recommendations of where we belong.
That would be fine.
So you see our other two options, which I won't go into detail, become an independent not-for-profit entity or become an independent state agency. In November 2015, the members of our commission voted to include the following three options as recommendations for this report. Become an independent state agency, affiliate with the Office of the Secretary of State, or affiliate with the Office of the Governor. And in the interest of time, I'd like to skip ahead because...
No matter what you choose, though, your commission, you still are going to need a subsidy, a
yes,
substantial subsidy. And let's make no mistake, colleagues, it's a general fund subsidy. And I think part of what needs to be in the discussion here, and I say this respectfully to your board members sitting behind you, we're going to go into arguably the worst budget cycle that we've seen in a long time in 17-19. And if I only have $250,000 for the sake of this conversation to spend, are you the best place to spend it? What's the downside? One of the things after we hear the explanation of the audit findings, I'd like to know if you have explored anything with respect to sustainability, fee for service, soliciting outside support from foundations and from the business community or others who see value in the services that you provide. I mean, I'm just making those up sitting here. But what you're really saying is no matter where we land, we still are going to need general fund support, and it's going to remain to the legislature to decide if there's value for the expenditure.
That is correct.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions up to this point? Okay. Madam Chair. Representative Nierman.
I apologize for coming in late. I had another conflict. But just out of an abundance of caution, I just want to disclose to the committee and to the public that I'm on the CASA Board of Directors.
Thank you.
So we have discussed the option with the Secretary of State of possibly being in the Secretary of State's office, and we've also discussed recently with the governor the possibility of being in the governor's office, and obviously there's lots of work to do to decide where the best home and best fit would be for us. But as we made our point in our report, the strongest commissions are those that are in the governor's offices, and they get a lot of benefit for the states in which they are part of that office. And that may be our long-term home, but we don't know yet as we investigate this. I would like to then, I think basically we're finished, and I'd like to turn it over to Mike.
Sure.
So that he can carry the ball on the audit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg, I'm Mike Fieldman. I'm the a member of the past chair, actually, of the commission and a current member of the commission of Oregon Volunteers. Just to give you a context for the audit finding that came up, the audit actually deals with 3 years of expenditures that occurred about 5 years ago.
2009 to 2011.
So this is expenditures that happened considerably long time ago, and that constituted about $13 million of expenditures within those 3 year period. In the audit review, when it was the federal reviewers that came in and did the review, they ultimately, originally they found many question costs in their audit, but they were questioned because they missed the information. They didn't find the documentation. We had to spend a significant amount of staff time getting them the information that they didn't find when they were here. There was about $750,000 in original question costs. All that documentation was there. The expenditures were fine. After several years, actually, of going back and forth with information to them, it finally boiled down to the $135,000 that was mentioned earlier, $137,000 that was mentioned earlier. So basically, just about 1% of what our total expenditures were of the whole $13 million that was being reviewed. Through that whole process, the commission has been actively engaged and involved in reviewing all the information. It was very transparent. We were sharing that information with OHCS. So it was a very transparent process. We were very open about what was going on and what the issues we were dealing with. Basically, the final $137,000 broke down into two sort of areas of question costs from the auditors. The first ones was what Kathleen alluded to earlier, that there were four of the agencies that we have AmeriCorps teams placed with that had, well, three of them had problems with doing the background checks appropriately within the guidelines that the National Corporation had for doing them. And this was a problem that, and it seems kind of interesting that three agencies would have the same problem at the same time. Well, there was a reason for that, because the National Corporation was at that time changing pretty regularly how those background checks were supposed to be done. They were changed at least three times. My agency, I run the United Community Action Network down in Roseburg, and we actually have, at the time, we had a 20-member AmeriCorps team and a 20-member VISTA team. We struggled with trying to get the background checks correctly and trying to figure out what was going on, because we were getting conflicting information and very poor information, not timely information. And to be quite honest, the reason we probably weren't on that list is partly because we did a good job, but partly of the sheer luck that we happened to hit it right. This was not a problem just for Oregon. This was a problem across the whole United States. And so there were other, many, many other states that got caught up in this also. So, but in the long run, there were three agencies that had not done the background checks correctly. Just to give you an idea, example of one of those situations, the regulations used to require that if there was a break of service for more than 30 days, there had to be a new background check done. Well, the AmeriCorps members' terms of office is 11 months. And so we had agencies, this had one agency where members had done a very good job. They actually decided they wanted to do a second year. And so, but they had the month off and another couple of weeks before their second term started. And the agency just didn't think to do another background check because they had already done one. And there hadn't, the people that's been around, they knew who they were. That was a technicality they got caught on, and because of that, they're having to pay money back. The regulations now, the National Corporation realized that that was a poor policy to have. The regulations now give you 3 months. There's a break of 3 months before you have to do another background check. So that would, but they got caught up in the technicality. So those four agents or three agencies have accepted the audit findings, and they are paying back that money to Oregon Housing Community Services. So there is no loss to the state or to the OHCS for that. The other remaining portion of the other section of it was a question on administrative costs, and what it had to deal with is the match that we're required. We mentioned we had a dollar-for-dollar match that we have to do. We had actually come up with a plan for creating that match. And by the way, part of the reason we're had to go through this process and other states don't have to is because we don't get general fund dollar support. In other states where they get general fund dollar support, that is used for the match. And it's very clear, very upfront, very, very easy to for the auditors to say, okay, there's the general fund dollars, they match the federal dollars that come in. Because we haven't had to do that, we've had to look for other ways of doing it. The way we did came, the approach we came up is that because we work through Portland State University, they have an indirect cost rate that's, like many universities, very, very high. They give us a break on that. They give us a lower indirect cost rate than what they charge for other places. We were using that difference as the match for our federal grant. We had run that idea by the National Corporation in a letter. They had approved it. They had authorized it. And we thought we were good with that. Then the auditor came in, and he had a different opinion about how that was done, that the appropriateness of that, and questioned those costs. We still think that there's a problem with that finding. I want to read from you the letter that we got, the final letter we just got last week from the National Corporation. I'm going to sort of synopsize a couple of the sentences down. It says, Oregon volunteers cannot apply the university indirect cost rate. And by the way, they said University of Oregon's indirect cost rate, and it actually was Portland State University, so that gives you the quality of the letter that we're dealing with, and the university's indirect cost rate as its own. Oregon Volunteers has its own federally approved indirect cost rate, and that is the rate that must be applied. That's the foundation. That's the basis that they disallowed our indirect cost rate. The problem with that is Oregon Volunteers does not have an indirect cost rate. We've never had an indirect cost rate. Yet in their audit letter, they're saying the reason they gave us an allowable cost is because we had one. We don't have one. We want to continue to push back on that. We've gone through all the formal processes. We want to try some informal processes to try and push back on that. We understand that OHCS may not want to do that because, you know, they have other things to do. They've gone through their formal process. But as a commission, we take this very seriously. And for as a commission, we feel like our credibility is sort of on the line. And so we want to push back on that. And whether we'll be successful or not, I don't know. But we're not ready to give up on it because we feel like there was a mistake made at the federal level. We think the audit was not a very good one to begin with, as the letter I just read section from indicates. And we want to see what we can do. If we're successful, then there won't be any additional cost. That exception will go away. If, in fact, in the long run, we are not successful with that and that audit exception still exists, we do have some strategies that we think that we can utilize existing resources to cover that so that, again, there wouldn't be any additional cost to OHCS. We appreciate the work that OHCS and the support that they have done for us over the years. And we really don't want them to be the ones that have to suffer for what we think are the mistakes really of the national corporation that exists not only within the mistakes that exist not only here but nationally that have had. So that is sort of the nutshell version of it. So
thank you. Colleagues, any questions? I have one. Tell us a little bit about the mechanics of the appeal.
We've gone through several appeals. I think Kathleen can probably do a better job with that than I can. We've gone through several, you know, basically about 5 years of appeals with them and giving them additional information. And so this is the final letter that came in last week.
Okay. I guess that begs the question. Okay. Had any disclosure been made to the legislature that you were having these kinds of audit problems in the 5 years that you've been trying to resolve this?
We needed to get down to a final resolution of the issue because, like you say, the many of the costs that they were questioning weren't really question costs. They were just the fact that they did not find the information when they first came, or they had it and they overlooked it. And so when I, my own age, I've been dealing with audits for 40 years, and we deal with, you know, when I deal with my own board, when we're dealing with an auditor and there's questions that there, we work with the auditors, we help them to understand how the systems work, and it isn't really until the final, we get the final report that we will report to my, I'll report to my board of directors. That's, at least in my world, that's the general, the normal process of things, because sometimes auditors miss things. Sometimes they make mistakes. And before we will go out into the public and make statements, we want to make sure that they've had a chance to correct their mistakes. They had about a 7-to-1 ratio of mistakes. There was about, they say, $750,000 in original question cost that ultimately boiled down to $135,000. And that was because they missed things. That's because they didn't do their job correctly. I know it's a little hard to realize, but sometimes there is not always competent activity at the federal level. So,
colleagues, any questions?
I'm shocked and appalled.
I know. Me too.
All right, Ms. Joy.
Senator Johnson's, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, I would say that it is very unusual. We received the original report in June of 2012. There, by law, is a 90-day requirement before in which we have to submit information, and they are supposed to submit a management decision. We did not receive the management decision until August 24th, 2015. That's when the timing would have become public in when it would have shown up on the federal website that there were problems, not until the issuance of the management decision letter. So the 90 days stretched to over 3 years before.
Has interest been accruing during that period of time against the arrearage irregularity?
No, and because housing was diligent about making sure that we paid off the debt the minute that we got the letter, no interest has accrued on these final costs. They were paid in full, so there will be no extra interest paid on
even with further appeal?
No.
Right. Okay.
Right. It's not pretty, but it's been managed, I think, as cleanly as a flawed process could be managed.
Well, I was very appreciative to have the explanation. I have to tell you, I have reached my tolerance with agency heads that make these catastrophic financial decisions that result in loss to the state. And then it's just like, oops. I think that the legislature has seen way too much of this. And when I first heard that there had been inappropriate grants to grantees that either hadn't been monitored or that there was an audit finding, as I said in my earlier remarks, I was set to come down here and ask for your resignation. But this seems to be a plausible explanation about what happened. It still begs the larger question, and that's what happens with your agency.
Right.
And while all of your choices are very interesting on their surface, it's really just rearranging chairs on the Titanic.
Well,
Have you had any discussion as a board about sustainability, self-sufficiency?
We have had years of conversations about that. I've personally visited with some of the foundations, with the Ford Family Foundation. That's where I'm from, Roseburg. I know that those people very well. We're just not a fit. When I talk, Ford Family Foundation doesn't give to government entities. They don't give to entities that serve in urban areas. And so our program serves all throughout the whole state. We're just not a fit for a lot of the foundations. We've talked to corporations. We do have some support from corporations. Wells Fargo has been a very strong supporter of the governor's volunteer awards every year. But as far as operational costs support, that's just not a reality. So yes, we have a job. I agree. We have a job to convince the legislature that we are of value. I feel we are of value. I've been involved with AmeriCorps programs since 1990. In fact, I was involved with AmeriCorps programs before they were AmeriCorps programs. It was originally started out of a model that was done in the state of Washington, the Washington National the Service Corps, which became the model for AmeriCorps. I happen to run an agency in Washington that had one of the original Washington Service Corps programs. I've seen the value of AmeriCorps programs in our communities, and they can have a significantly positive impact throughout all Oregon on just a variety of areas, from working with kids to working with environmental issues, working with Kathleen can talk about all the different things we do. We have AmeriCorps members working in our alternative schools. There's just a variety of things they can do. So I know the value. We know the value. That's why the commission is here and so strong, because we believe in what we do. But I agree, we have a better job to do.
If you didn't exist, is there another pathway for that federal money to come to the state? Because you mentioned $13 million
right.
over the period of the audit. Could you explain how that money is expended?
I'll let Kathleen do
sure. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, the money comes to us in two ways for AmeriCorps. It comes through a population-based formula that is totally controlled by the commissioners. So they make all the decisions on what local entities are going to receive that money. And then
stop. You've just said something contradictory, that it's totally based on population, yet your commissioners get to make the decisions.
On how we distribute that
within the populated areas.
It's the total population of the state. So the federal allocation is based on the state's population, just as it is for our administrative money. So that's one pool of money that we use for funding AmeriCorps. The second pool is an opportunity that allows states to obtain additional AmeriCorps funding by competing high-quality AmeriCorps programs that operate in only one state against other high-quality programs that only operate in one state and against programs that operate in multiple states. So for in Oregon, we have Jesuit Volunteer Corps Northwest, we have Food Corps, we have Vet Corps, we have a number of programs that place members in Oregon, although they are supplemental to what we're funding through our portfolio.
Let me stop you again. You've talked about vets. I presume that's veterans.
Yes.
You mentioned the Jesuits.
Yes.
I'm just thinking, just as you're ticking those off with knowing absolutely nothing about them.
Yes.
But I'm aware of veterans raising money for a variety of good causes, none the least of which is to put signage all throughout the state of Oregon on our various highways, east,
yes,
west, and north, south. So I don't know whether seeking support from veterans organizations, the VFW, American Legion, and you mentioned the Jesuits, whether or not there's any opportunity there. My perception, and that's all it is that the Jesuits have available resources, special offerings, all sorts of. Have you explored any outside revenue to support these activities where they're getting AmeriCorps volunteers?
Those programs are all funded nationally, so they're not in our portfolio. I will tell you that the 6.3 $6 million that we're administering this biennium is matched by $6.1 million in local funding now. That's the match for what we do. The AmeriCorps grant from the federal government is inadequate to run and administer an AmeriCorps program. Mike could tell you that now the amount of money that a sponsoring organization receives for an AmeriCorps member does not even cover their stipend and their health insurance. So local programs have to do raise significant additional funds in order to host the program in their community.
Do you have a breakdown of those revenue sources?
Of where it's coming from in each local program area? We could certainly obtain that for you. Yes, we would be happy to do that.
Okay. Representative Woodson.
I was wondering if you could provide us with how many employees or what your overhead is for people who administer this money. I assume they're employed by the state of Oregon if they're through the governor's office then?
We are. If you look on page 14 of the report, you will see that there are four of us that do this work. That includes a CASA coordinator, a national service program administrator, me, and an events and project specialist who manages the governor's volunteer awards and all the training for AmeriCorps members. So there are four of us that do that. We have a hybrid staffing. We do not have, at one point the commission had adequate FTE to cover all the members of the staff, but before I arrived, some of that was traded by my predecessor to our former agency. So we now have a hybrid staff with two staff members who are PSU employees and two staff members who are State of Oregon employees. There is a statement of a grant award between Housing and Community Services and PSU to reimburse for those expenses with our federal funding. But this is an organization that is quite gerrymandered and kind of held together with baling wire and something or another duct tape that goes back to the fact that there was never even an executive order when it was created. It's kind of just slid along for 22 years doing its work as well as it could under the circumstances of little recognition. And it was heartbreaking for this commission to come to the point where they realized that we needed to say out loud, this is no longer sustainable without help. It is not an easy thing to say, but it is a fact that there are no further reductions that could be made and keep the program viable as it is now.
Let me understand something. The AmeriCorps volunteers come to you with no training, and it is on the receiving state of the funds to train the AmeriCorps volunteers?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, probably two-thirds of the AmeriCorps members that serve in Oregon have some college, maybe half of them have a college degree. So they are not coming untrained, but what they do not have is specific skills in the programmatic area where they are working. Mike has people who are working in alternative education, who are working in health clinics, who are doing on-the-ground work, all for locally identified community needs where skill enhancement needs to happen.
There's much of this I do not understand, but it seems to beg the question about workforce. And I don't know where these young people, I presume they're young people,
yes,
are from. If they're Oregonians, do they qualify for support out of our employment department? And why, if you've got this incredibly diverse portfolio where you're placing students, why don't you curtail the portfolio and bring down your training costs? And I have no idea. I've attended the events, the luncheon. I have no idea what the costs of that are. I would agree with you that you can't thank volunteers enough. but we are not going to have adequate resources to fund all of these programs,
That's
regardless
correct.
Of how worthy they are. And rather than discussing with you where your shingle is going to be hung out, I need to know, as a member of Ways and Means, as many of us are, what are we buying? What's the downside if, regardless of where you go, there's no support? Has the governor's office talked seriously about the impact of absorbing your support, or the Secretary of State, or Portland State? Or if you became a freestanding agency, you'd just be in here asking for money? And given your explanation of the paucity of staff, that seems to open the door for more staff, which seems to at least suggest to me an ongoing general fund responsibility to keep paying for you as you restaff. Have you looked at service and program delivery cuts?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, the way the program works is we have how many different agencies that we have teams in that through
11.
The commission? 11?
11.
11 teams through the commission. And so the number of programs we have are based upon the amount of funding we get from the federal government. So what happens is, like, my agency, which has now AmeriCorps team and has had this for several years, we have to apply every 3 years for to be an AmeriCorps team, and we apply to the commission for that. And then we have to have in that plan all the things that we're going to do within our community with the 20-member AmeriCorps team. What we do with our AmeriCorps team is that we actually then go out to the communities in Southern Oregon, Southwest Oregon, all the nonprofits and government entities and schools and all that, and say, could you use an AmeriCorps member to help you with your mission, whatever it is you're doing? They apply to us then. We have, usually for 20 slots, we'll have 25 to 30 applicants for those positions. We do the screening process on it, and we make the decisions then which are going to be the best sites to host an AmeriCorps member. And then we monitor that. We monitor all the activities within that. We make sure that the background checks are done okay. That really falls on my agency, UCAN, and not on the commission up here. That's my responsibility as a contractor with the commission to make sure that all works well. We cut the checks to the paychecks, to the volunteers. The volunteers get a stipend. It's not technically a paycheck, and it's at poverty wages. It's not very much. So there
give
is
us
no,
an example.
You have to give me what that is.
This year, it's $12,300 for a term of service of 1,700 hours. It's below minimum wage, but it is not a wage.
Right.
It is a stipend.
Right. And so there is no cost to the unemployment, or we pay for workman's comp on it out of our grant. So in order for an agency to have an AmeriCorps member, they have to pay a fee for that. And the fees vary from agency to agency. Within my agency, the fee varies between about $6,000 and $7,500 a year that an agency has to pay to have that AmeriCorps member. In other agencies, it's higher. I think we're at the lower end of it.
What if it went up to $12,000 for you? You're still under this arrangement.
Right.
You're still getting a much less well-compensated employee than you would if you were hiring someone at even minimum wage. So what would happen if there was an additional $5,000 assessment? I'm just making these numbers up.
Right. We would probably have half as many, if any, people apply to have the AmeriCorps members. These are nonprofit agencies that are struggling to make ends meet to begin with. And so there's a cutoff point where if we get it too high, we lose the applicants, and then the AmeriCorps members are not available to help out in the local community. So,
Representative Woodson.
My single experience with AmeriCorps involved a lovely young girl from very, very, very inner city, large city in California that was assigned to Klamath County. And she came out and she was going to tell us how to do agriculture, for example. And so I'm just questioning, what in the world are they doing when you see situations like that? We had to train her, the local people, because she had never been on a ranch before, but she was coming out to tell the locals how to utilize their food, but she had never been on a ranch or seen cattle or anything else. And so I just have a really hard time understanding what the whole program is about when we get people like this into our communities. They're not helping our communities. Right. We're helping to teach them,
right,
at least in the experience that
right.
I saw.
Senator, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and committee members, it may vary. That particular situation I can't answer, because as Kathleen mentioned, there are basically two flavors, I guess, of AmeriCorps members that exist in the state. One are the ones that run through the commission. The other ones are ones that are in the state that are placed here by national corporations or national organizations. We have no control over them. They compete at the national level. They get funded at the national level. They place AmeriCorps members throughout the United States. So I don't know in this case if that was one of those. But when we hire our AmeriCorps members, one of the things we look at, and we work with our member agencies in the screening, they go through a screening process. They get a list of all the numerous AmeriCorps members who are interested in coming to this area. They often express the types of work they would like to do. And then the member agencies actually go and they interview those people, and they hire them in a sense. They go through a whole hiring process. And so we encourage them, if there's somebody who you don't think is going to add value to what you're wanting to do, don't hire them, because you are going to be doing that training that needs to happen. My experience with the AmeriCorps members that we've had working in my agency, they've been very well qualified. We have to give them an orientation to the community. That's part of the normal process of bringing anybody in. We get people from some people from Oregon, and we get people from all over the country coming here. And in rural area, actually, it's one of the few ways that we get younger kids to come into our community and stay, because we've had AmeriCorps members stay in our community and become viable members of our community. But we encourage our agencies to hire people who are going to add value, and for the most part, that is our experience, is they do add value to them. So whether a national entity just hires people and plops them in the middle of your community, I would agree with you. That we have problems sometimes with how that's done, but we unfortunately don't control that.
I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. We are in receipt of a report based on a budget note. That's all. I'm not sure how much new ground we're going to plow here.
Okay.
We're working at an insane pace this session, and so we're going to lose some members. And we still have an informational hearing on the key performance measures. I think perhaps, and I would beg for a contradiction from many of my colleagues, I think you see some level of concern among this committee about how the program operates, whether or not the subsidy is a wise expenditure. I think is all we're going to do is to receive the report today and report it out to full. But it is my opinion that you've got your work done cut out for you. And I think that I would be safe in saying none of us need to hear the value of volunteers and the value of exposing young people to all sorts of different parts of our great nation. What we want to know is the nuts and bolts of how this works and why a subsidy, regardless of where you're located, is good value for Oregon taxpayers.
Yes.
And that's really the question. Colleagues, I don't want to put words in the committee's mouth, but I think that kind of sums it up.
And we don't disagree with that assessment.
Okay. So with that, Ms. Deister, I think you have a recommendation, and we'll go from your comments.
Correct. Co-chairs and members of the committee, again, this report was being brought to you as a result of the budget note in the 2015 regular session. So we will be needing a recommendation to acknowledge receipt of the report, which is the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation. I would note there was a question about, you know, next steps, and those would likely come forward in 2017-19 during that regular budget process. You may very well see a package request either from housing or on behalf of Oregon Volunteers or on behalf of housing itself. That would likely, based upon this report from the LFO analysis of it, likely include additional funding as well to support the agency operations based upon the challenges that they've put forward to you today. The should the legislature make that determination that additional funding can't be accommodated because of competing priorities, then the consequences of that, you would have the option, I guess, to modify the statute to change responsibilities to a certain degree. Many of those responsibilities are, in fact, governed by the federal government and the federal AmeriCorps program, or to dismantle the commission. But if you did that, what you would be looking at is $6.6 million in federal volunteer-related grant funds that we wouldn't be seeing, $6 million in local match, and the $5 million in education awards that can be utilized by the AmeriCorps members themselves. So, and you would also, as mentioned by Mr. Diaz earlier, need to find a new administrative entity for the court-appointed special advocates program. So with that, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report. It's not, you know, never the type of report I think that people like to hear, but...
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Before I entertain a motion from Co-Chair Gomberg with respect to the LFO recommendation, my curiosity has been piqued. I notice in the audience behind you some folks that I would consider professional advocates. Have you retained, for lack of a better word, lobbying services?
No, we have not.
Okay, thank you.
We don't have the funding to do it.
Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to go ahead and move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you. Colleagues, you have heard the LFO recommendation. Are there any questions, any discussion, any objection? So ordered, and I will take it to full because I believe that this has to come to full as it is a result of a budget note.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We will close the work session on Housing and Community Services, specifically the Oregon Commission on Voluntary Action and Service. And I will open an informational hearing on key performance measure updates, Housing and Community Services Department, Ms. Van Vliet.
If I may take a moment.
Ms. Deister.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What you have before you is basically an update from Housing and Community Services on a redesign of its key performance measures. They were initially asked to do this back in 2013 with the redesign of the service delivery model for the department, and they have are now ready to give a starting point, if you will, of kind of the direction that they're headed. I would just encourage the subcommittee to provide thoughts, comments, and feedback, because that will help inform my eventual recommendation on things that you would like to see and the direction, the types of things that you want this agency to measure as we go forward during the 2017 regular budget review process.
Thank you very much, Ms. Van Vliet.
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. As you have heard, back in 2012, then Governor Kitzhaber directed my agency to re-examine service delivery models, partnerships, and programs. And as part of our report back to the legislature, the agency was directed by this subcommittee to revise our key performance measures. I'm happy to report today that the agency has completed the transition efforts. We are making important strides towards our goals. Those goals include reorienting our work towards facilitation and service on behalf of communities we serve, to drive our business and policy decisions based on data and research, to reduce our costs of program delivery and match those costs to available revenue, and to align our housing investments with the work of other state agencies while strengthening policy and governance systems. Presenting progress on redesigning our key performance measures is part of our goal to become more driven by data and research and to make business and policy decisions based on data. As we set out to do this work, we established criteria that we felt were important in establishing any new KPMs or keeping existing KPMs. So quickly, you can see them here. The first criteria, it sounds silly, but it turns out to be important, that it's simple to explain and uses clear language, that data is actually readily available for both the agency performance and our targets, that we are measuring performance for all of our major program areas, if at all possible, that methodologies are standardized and well documented, that targets are either based on past performance, actual goals, or some other identifiable measure and reasoning is documented, and the new KPMs should be things that the agency can influence. So what I'm going to do is go through our existing KPMs and tell you which ones we run keep as is, which ones we think ought to be modified slightly, and which ones we're recommending no longer be used. This first one is about our single family programs. Our current KPM seeks to measure how well we are doing at serving lower income housing households with our residential loan programs. That program, I think you know, is a below market rate, a below market interest rate loan program. The measure has actually been difficult to understand and explain, and our recommended revision is simply to change the format of the measure from a ratio to a percentage to be more understandable. I personally have struggled with this one. I'm in favor of this. So obviously I'm recommending all of them, but this one I think is a pretty easy fix. So what we want to revise it to is the percentage of households at or below the state's median income served by our residential loan program. We anticipate our target for this KPM will be 60%. Currently our bond programs can serve families up to 140% of area median income. The slide does show you the number of residential loans over the last 5 years made to first-time home buyers, just as a data point. We are actually hoping to increase production going forward, but that gives you a sense of the scale. We have another recommended new KPM in the single-family programs. The percentage of loans from OHCS residential loan programs made to people of color. As you know, homeownership is one of the greatest factors in the creation of wealth, and there remains a gap in the wealth between white households and households of color. We are recommending a KPM that measures the percentage of residential loans issued to people of color. The 2014 American Community Survey shows that 16.6% of Oregon households are non-white and non-Hispanic. Ideally, we would want our target to be reflective of the state's population and demographics. We'd like to do more work on this with the benefit of our Housing Stability Council, but we think this is an important policy area for us to pay attention to.
Good question.
Representative Whitsitt, excuse me.
So is this then based solely on race then? Are you meeting some criteria to increase non-white just because of race then?
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg and Representative Whitsitt, yes, the idea would be to target and make sure that communities of color who are underrepresented in homeownership, and we do know that there are documented cases, we don't think with our programs, but the communities of color, households of color, do have a harder time finding mortgage financing. And so we want to make sure the state's programs are very clear and intentional in pursuing communities of color with the program.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So if people of color are less participating in home ownership, then just by targeting people who participate less in home ownership, you'd meet this goal then automatically without trying to target people of color.
Co-chairs Gomberg and Johnson and Representative Nierman, I think the approach, and we hear this from our homeownership advocates on the ground, some of them are working really hard to make sure that historically disadvantaged groups, which includes communities of color, have access to things like homebuyer education, and that they know how to access a good mortgage, and that they know how to find a lender who is responsible. We just want to make sure that since it's a public resource, that the public resource is really available, and we're not inadvertently leaving anybody out, and that we're doing some more targeted outreach. Again, I would say that the Housing Stability Council, which is very interested in helping us think about social equity and addressing those kinds of disparities with all of our programs, is eager to help us chart out the right path for this, for achieving, for setting a target and then achieving goals against the target.
Follow.
Thank you. So, so then, if you were to assist Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey and Clarence Thomas, you'd be meeting that goal. Then, I mean, I would think that there would be other ways that you could be effective other than by targeting color. You could target neighborhoods, you know, to that were disadvantaged or something like that. I would think that I don't know. It just it seems to me to be kind of pretty harsh to say we're gonna divide up the world by color and go service one color there, whatever color it might be.
So. Co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg and Representative Nierman, I think I understand the point you're making. We want more homeownership for everybody. Mm-hmm. We'd like to think there's not a limited pot of how many homeownership loans there can be. As we expand our offerings and as we're thinking about offering more loans out in Oregon communities, we want to make sure that we don't do what historically has been done, which is the mortgage systems are not equally accessible to households of color. And there's data nationally and locally that validates that. So we want to make sure that we're not inadvertently skipping over communities of color who have been historically disadvantaged in this arena. I think the other point I would make is there are income caps. And so this is always going to be low and moderate income households that get access to this kind of financing.
Not Michael Jordan.
Representative Whitson.
Isn't it against the law to discriminate against someone based on color? If you're right now, if you go to get a mortgage loan, you would be in so much trouble you couldn't even see straight. So we're not talking about past. We're talking about right now. And so isn't it true that a loan institution can't discriminate against someone based on color if they meet the criteria?
Yes, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg and Representative Whitsitt, absolutely. We want to say yes to everybody, but we know that households of color access home ownership in far smaller numbers than white households. And so this is a measure to say, not that, and understand that these loans come to us through originators. So we are not the front door. We have something like 14 mortgage originators out in the community. They're banks and community banks. And we want to make sure that they're offering their product and the product that we stand behind, that we buy that mortgage, that we're doing everything we can to make sure no one is disadvantaged. So it wouldn't be that we would pick a household of color over a white household. It would be that we make sure we're doing outreach so that both are represented in their proportion in which they exist in Oregon.
Thank you. Please continue.
So the next one is about multifamily housing, which is, I think you know, our biggest program area, multifamily rental development. The current KPM measures the percentage of housing units funded with grants, tax credits, bonds, excluding housing market rate housing units that will be affordable to households earning less than 60% of the area median income. Now, the majority, the vast majority of our funding sources do prioritize households earning at or below 60. We know that the need for affordable housing is actually greater for lower income households. So we'd like to revise this KPM to measure how well we're doing serving households with incomes at or below 50% of area median income. The recommended revision then is to the percentage of regulated multifamily housing units funded with grants, tax credits, and bonds, with rents set at levels that are affordable to households earning 50% of area median income.
Ms. Van Vliet, if you change this, I'm trying to picture these new performance measures that your agency is going to be held accountable for, and I'm thinking of some of the enormously complex housing legislation that's coming through this session that I would add parenthetically. I has no business, in my opinion, in a short session. I'm trying to figure out if some of this stuff passes. Are you setting yourself up for performance measures that may be influenced by outside factors, like the decision of developers not to do multifamily if some of this stuff passes?
Co-Chair Johnson, I think I understand your question. I'm not I'm not concerned about that, but I think it's worth reflecting on. And what I would offer is that, again, the Housing Stability Council, which is our statutorily named advisory body, is I think a good place for us to sort of vet that. They're watching this legislation very carefully, and I don't think that what I know based on legislation that's currently in the building, I don't think this would we would get tangled up in that, but I think we'll have the opportunity to confirm that before we ask you to adopt these.
Thank you. Senator Hansel.
We'll have the same concerns that Co-Chair Johnson has, and I look at this. At 60 AMI, your results are pretty significant, 94%.
Correct.
You're that close to, right. I don't know how you get any closer to 100%, and now you're reducing it even more. But I guess I'm not understanding
right. Okay.
What you're trying to accomplish.
What are we trying to accomplish? So Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg and Senator Hansel. I think, let me phrase it a different way. Pretty much all of our money requires us to be at 60% or below, so it's not a stretch. So we can meet this target pretty well. There's a few sources that let us go up to 80. What we're saying is we know there's more need for even lower income, more affordable apartments. We want to stretch ourselves and say, let's direct relatively more of our financing to produce low units for lower income families. We need to do some data analytics and sort of set a target that is both a stretch but not unreasonable. And so I think the point is it's pretty easy to meet this one because that's what the federal rules tell us to do already. And we think as a policy matter, we would recommend pushing incomes down.
Okay. Please continue.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit lost. All right. Also in the multifamily area, this is for the percentage of affordable rental housing units developed that provide rental opportunities for low incomes, seniors, families with special needs compared to the percentage of the state's population that are low income with special needs. This is a very confusing KPM, and we really think it needs to be clarified. The term special needs that we are using could mean many different things to many different people. We think we owe it to special populations to be more clear about what we're talking about. We have historically used it to talk about people with different kinds of disabilities, veterans, farm workers. We need a clearer definition and some clear policy parameters about why we would go after those special populations. We do plan to do more intentional statewide housing planning this year, and we'd like to lean on some better planning work and better outreach to come up with a more refined measure here. Again, I think it's important that we do direct resources to special populations that have a harder time accessing housing, but this measure is pretty hard to manage and the definitions need to be cleaned up.
I agree completely, and I'm trying to reconcile this performance measure against the governor's direction that the $40 million that was appropriated from the legislature largely be focused on people that already are in contact with DHS, mothers and small children that are already under case management. That concerns me when that legislative and gubernatorial direction apparently has come, and there are many of us on this panel who are advocates for veterans, for mentally ill. I know you meant to say mentally ill, and you just left it out of your run of. And so I'm trying to reconcile how you're able to better define special needs against the white noise of getting direction from the executive branch about where their emphasis is.
Yeah. Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee, I think a couple of answers to that. I think we'll get through the LIFT program, frankly, in the coming year and a half. And I think these will be set in the 17-19 biennium. And my hope is that I will show you a better, more comprehensive housing plan with our identification of needs for different populations, and that we have a different conversation about where the agency should prioritize funding. I also think it's possible we're going to come and say, how about for federal tax credits? it's any sort of workforce population or low-wage workers, but for these other pots of money, let's target them to these populations. I think we want to get to a place where we have a more nuanced conversation as we think about how you want to hold us accountable through KPMs. We'll need to come back to this. I don't want to leave it the way it is, so I think we need to do something.
The other concern that I have is, and I don't mean to have this sound as harsh as it's going to sound, but picking winners and losers. You, I think, had articulated in your earlier testimony you want the water in the harbor to float and all the boats will rise. But I think a caution here is in creating these silos, and when the silo's full, I would presume it's capped, and so that I think that's a concern.
Okay. I think that's a good concern to note. And I think, you know, with all of these KPMs and the way we think about our work, we're rationing scarce dollars. We're saying yes to some and no to others. That's the nature of this business. And so
we have 5 minutes left, and I'm hoping you get to the KPM that says we're building more units. We're foregoing granite countertops. We're putting in formica, and we're getting more bang for our buck.
All right, let's talk about construction costs. So we are actually, Madam Chair, recommending we not have this as a KPM. I understand fully the strong interest in managing and measuring and reporting on what it costs. There are too many things outside the agency's control. I recommend it is not appropriate for it to be a performance measure for the agency. There's federal rules, there's land costs, there's a lot of things we don't control. So I'm recommending we drop this one.
I'm speaking only for myself. No. I would rather have you come in and say we set this measure of 208, if I can see that, and we missed it by a gazillion dollars, but we fought like hell to get federal regulations changed. I mean, I want to know the story.
Okay.
And I think it's important for Oregonians to know how much the housing is costing that their tax money is helping to provide. And, you know, I've heard estimates as high as $400 a square foot. I don't know whether that's anecdotal, but that's an outrage. And I would be loath personally to give up any economic measure of what we're doing.
Okay. All right.
I concur.
Representative, what's it?
I agree, and I'm looking at these numbers, and in my area, you could buy the finest luxury home available for the lowest amount that you have on there. I'm just blown away that you don't want to say what this is really costing, because it, I mean, people who are out there paying for their homes with their own money will just be flabbergasted at what this is costing the state, our tax dollars, to pay for this.
Noted.
Good. Please continue. We're on the home stretch here.
We're on the home stretch. This is a recommendation. It is emerging best practice nationally that we think about not concentrating poor people in high poverty areas, but that we instead intentionally look to site our housing, or at least a percentage of our housing, in high opportunity areas. So this is about deconcentrating poverty. It's not anything we've measured before. We think there are metrics that we could use to do it, and we can provide incentives in the way of sort of more points to be able to site properties in high opportunity areas.
Yeah. Representative Whitsitt.
Again, it drives the cost of housing up to do this. And just because you site someone in an area that costs more doesn't mean you're going to bring them up somehow. I mean, I don't understand this entire thing, and I'm sorry, I'm just a little upset about the whole presentation today, but I think we need to build housing for the lowest cost, wherever that is, that serves the most number of people, not put people in the Pearl District or wherever, to say we put poor people in the Pearl District. We need housing for lots of people, not fancy housing for a few people. Thank you.
Noted.
Sorry.
Okay, home stretch.
This is about reducing homelessness. You can read the text. We just want to slightly revise the language here, but basically keep it the same. When people are placed into permanent housing, we want to track them after 6 months and see how many are still there after they come out of shelters.
Again, this is a pretty nuanced, by the efforts of your agency.
The efforts of our partner agencies on the ground, which is primarily community action agencies.
Okay, because I'm in a big fight with NOAA this morning about a client, I mean a constituent. And so I'm trying to figure out how you're going to track all this data when you're not responsible for manipulating some of it.
Co-Chair Johnson, what happens is that the partners we work with, we send the grant dollars out to community action agencies. All these funds flow through community action agencies. They are required, not so much by us, but by the HUD dollars that go to them, to report at certain intervals and to track individuals. Okay. And so it's okay. Part of what they're wired to do.
Okay.
Energy savings, we recommend removing this one. The KPM is difficult to understand and explain. We are actually working, I think, well with the utilities and other stakeholders. We want to get their best thinking about what to replace this with. But
I'd like to know the percentage of money you choke out of the Energy Trust of Oregon that has the spigot permanently turned on to the point they can't spend that money fast enough, and we have people living under bridges.
It costs plus, excuse me.
Yes.
Noted. We are recommending a new energy services related KPM that has to do with disconnects and preventing disconnects as opposed to turning back on the lights and the heat after the fact. This is national best practice, working with partners, working across, looking across the country to see how people are using these kinds of resources. Customer service KPM, we've talked about this one. We took a big dip in the last year on this one. We're paying a lot of attention to that. I think it had probably mostly to do with the transition we were in. People were confused and worried about the agency. We have gotten some help to tune up the survey. We're scrubbing our lists. We're going to go back out next month with a survey that is section by section that we hope will give us actionable feedback. I hope the results are better, but if they're not, you'll see them, and we'll be back to have that discussion. The food program we no longer administer, so we would recommend that that does not belong with us any longer.
The only thing I would like to say about that is I think you need coordination. You've got the food people in here now who used to be food people but are now housing people. And I yelled at him about brand dilution. It used to be when the food bank came, you knew exactly what they were talking about. They're now working on housing, too. There needs to be some level of coordination, and I would welcome some articulation from the agency about how you're going to coordinate all of this. Otherwise, it looks like a box of mice people tipped over in this building, everybody running around looking for the same stuff. It makes it very difficult for policymakers to know how to proceed.
Understood.
Okay. Is that it, Ms. Van Vliet?
That's it.
Colleagues, I know we went through this at a very rapid pace, and I apologize for that and the bad time management, but I think that preceding conversation was important and necessary. I'm going to ask any of you that have further comments to get them in writing either to our professional staff, Ms. Deister, or to Ms. Van Vliet. And if there are comments, would either one of you please share the comments with the rest of the committee?
Definitely.
Anything else for the good of the order? Ms. Deister.
I would just thank you all for your comments and feedback. I've been noting them so that as we go forward with in 17, we'll have some of that basis to compare what housing brings to us.
So. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll be very, very brief. And Ms. Van Vliet knows that I have continuing interest in delinquent debt within the state of Oregon, money that Oregonians owe Oregon. The debt that this agency has is minuscule compared to most. In the last LFO report, it was $3 million. But I'd like to see all of our agencies starting to take a look at delinquent debt, putting that in as a KPM, and reporting back to us on how much they think they can collect. If we could get half that money, I think everybody at this table has an idea where they'd like to spend $1.5 million.
I personally would wish to be associated with the co-chair. Anything else for the good of the order? There being none, we're adjourned. There being none, we're adjourned. For the good of the order.